Henselminutes.com. It's Hensel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 49, recorded Tuesday, January 30th, 2007. Support for Hensel Minutes is provided by Slash N Software Red Carpet Subscriptions, the most comprehensive solution for adding connectivity to your .NET and ASP.NET applications. With components for every major internet protocol, online at www.nsoftware.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine, online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with PowerShell developer Bruce Payette.
Hi, welcome to Hansel Minutes. Here's another episode. I'm Scott Hanselman. Carl's taking a break on this show, and I am sitting down with Bruce Payette of Microsoft and PowerShell fame. I've done a couple of talks on PowerShell before, and you know that I'm a PowerShell fanboy and a big fan of Jeffrey Snover's. Jeffrey Snover, one of the architects of PowerShell. And Jeffrey, while I was interviewing him for Channel 9, was very quick to throw the credit Bruce's way when it comes to the designing of the language. He called you a language encyclopedia, Bruce.
It's a hobby, so I guess that's kind of true.
And how much history do you have as far as programming language? How many different languages do you know?
To say how many you know, it's a question of what do you use currently. And so I've played with probably hundreds of different languages at different times. But what am I fluent with at any given time? These days, it's PowerShell and C# more than anything else. I was a big fan of Tickle. I spent a lot of time doing Unix-style scripting languages, working at MKS, who did the Mortise Kern Tools Toolkit, which was Unix tools on DOS. We did a lot of stuff with POSIX and standardizing the Unix scripting languages.
How many, I think you probably have an opinion about the, quote-unquote, the young kids these days, probably myself included, folks. If you've had hundreds of languages that you've been exposed to, I think my first language was C. I'm in my mid-30s. My first language was C. I've done VB, little Haskell, some Tickle, but probably not more than a dozen languages. How important is it for someone in 2007 who's a programmer to have that historical context around all the different languages out there?
I don't know that it's necessarily all that important. It's good to have an understanding of sort of the range and capabilities of a language. But actually, Anders Helsberg, who is the architect of C#, makes a really good point that the languages themselves are becoming less interesting and it's really the libraries that matter. And the same point's been brought up for Perl, that Perl as a language is not that interesting. It's CPAN. It's all the libraries. CPAN is the language of the internet and Perl is just syntax, is I think the quote. But understanding, having a good understanding of, especially languages like Haskell, just to get a sense of the range. I know most introductory computer science courses start teaching, they usually teach a fairly conventional language like Java, and then something a little stranger. It used to be Prolog. It's probably Haskell this week. But it gives people a sense of the range of expression. I mean, after all, languages are designed for people, not for computers. Computers just care about bits and bytes. If you can't express your ideas in a language, then it's not much good, is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's all about expressing your intent as clearly as possible. Now, you use the term conventional language. I assume that Java, C#, VB are all kind of conventional languages with fairly straightforward procedural constructs, right?
Pretty much, yes.
Why is it that quote-unquote unconventional languages aren't mainstream?
They haven't been for a long time for a variety of reasons. Implementations, not good implementations was part of it. They required, like certain early versions of Smalltalk, for example, required very, very powerful hardware. And not everybody could afford that. Now we have machines with very powerful hardware. That's not an issue anymore. And we're starting to see some of the features of some of the more advanced languages coming into the mainstream. And probably the best example of this is the Lync stuff that's coming with C#3.0 and VB9. So you look at it and you think, oh, that's not really all that radical. But Eric Meyer has this wonderful talk that I'd love to track down somewhere where he talks about how they basically took a lot of the functional programming elements of Haskell and made them mainstream. And I think that's really interesting. It's finally some of the really interesting ideas in programming language research are starting to get into the mainstream.
So talk for our listeners who may not necessarily be familiar with some of the things that are coming with C Sharp 3.0, and I want to tie that back into PowerShell. Explain to me what a Lambda is and why that keeps coming up.
So a Lambda is also, we call them script blocks in PowerShell. It's an anonymous function. So it's the function body exists without any particular name, and you can pass them around as first-class objects. They've actually been in C Sharp since 2.0 in the form of anonymous delegates. And Java doesn't have lambdas really as such, but they have anonymous inner classes. So you still have this idea of an anonymous chunk of code drifting around, and that gives you some very powerful programming capabilities.
So in PowerShell, the language proper, to be clear, I've spoken to the people on the PowerShell team, and they all say, oh yeah, it's a language. It's a whole complete grammar. It's a programming language, but we're not compiling to it. But it is a whole distinct thing, right? It's not just a mishmash of a bunch of different languages. It has a whole formal grammar.
That's right. And actually, I include the grammar at the end of the book. I think Jeffrey has published part of the grammar on the PowerShell blog site at one point as well. But that's true of, I mean, the Corn Shell, for example. One of the things that the IEEE did with the POSIX standards was actually capture the Corn Shell grammar and publish it. So it's not most of the shells are languages. Some are more powerful than others.
And of course, you tried to make the most powerful one. Now, the book you mentioned, of course, is PowerShell in Action, and I've made it about 3/4 of the way through some galleys of it, and. I've said to a lot of people that this is going to be fantastic. I really, really enjoyed the first 3 chapters. The amount of information that it kind of ramps you up into the whole kind of gestalt of PowerShell is very, very quickly and very clearly. I think a lot of people have trouble when they see PowerShell for the first time because it seems like it's just so different from what I think people who don't have a historical perspective are used to. You don't just sit down and start going with PowerShell. Once you reach that, that level of familiarity, you kind of go over that hump, then you can just start running.
Right. And actually, somebody did a blog posting recently saying the first 4 minutes are the hardest. What's one of the things that we did, we made a conscious decision early on that we're designing a tool for professional users. It's not, it used to be the DOS was... The old command shell was how you worked with Windows. And so it had to be easy. It had to be easy enough for the entire range of users to use. Well, that's not an issue so much anymore because that's the role of the GUI now. So what we were doing was creating a tool that would allow professionals to do their job as effectively as possible. And these are people who will work with this tool on day in and day out. And so we traded off a little bit of ease of learning for a whole lot of power and ease of use.
Mm. Okay, so the first 4 minutes were not really a priority in the designing of the language. I don't suppose you designed anything in to make it obvious or intuitive for that first few minutes of use.
We did to some extent. So we have a lot of aliases. So the basic navigation in the shell, if you type dir and it'll work, and you type cd and it will work, and whether you're a Unix user, you can type ls and it will work. So you have some basic navigation. There's enough out of the box that you can do the kind of things that you would do in a traditional shell pretty easily. It's when you start to get into the more advanced programming stuff that, there's a lot of stuff in the sense that we have tab completion. So you have tools for exploring objects. You don't have to sit down and read a book or go to the website to look at an object. You can explore it directly in the PowerShell environment. So in that sense, we do provide a lot of stuff to help you get going. But we assume that you have some amount of knowledge about what you're trying to do. But it's also an interactive environment. It's an environment where you can explore and learn things incrementally. And that was very much part of it, was you could get started doing old-style batch-type scripting fairly easily. And then as you grow with the language, it grows with you. It gives you a lot more capability. We didn't want it to sort of... And I suppose this is one of the things that you saw a lot in the Unix shells, is you could get to a certain point with the Unix shell, and then you had to shift to a different tool. You had to shift to C, or you had to shift to awk, or eventually Perl. I mean, one of Perl's great strengths is that it's much more capable. It has a lot of stuff built into it. And so it didn't run out of steam as quickly. We wanted to try and get some of that with PowerShell. You can start with the shell and do some basic file operations, and that worked fine. And then you could do text operations, and you're still fine in the shell. And then you start to do some object stuff, and you're still fine in the shell. You don't have to go to another tool. You don't have to learn a language. It's one of the things you see in a Unix shell script is it's usually actually a mixture of a whole bunch of different languages. It will be a little bit of shell and awk and maybe some Perl. All these different syntaxes mixed together with quoting, and that's something we really wanted to avoid. And one of the, I think, the most common question that I got trying to, when I was maintaining awk at MKS was, how do you use awk and pass arguments into it from the shell and get all the quoting right? And even with an expert, it was still hard.
It seems like in shell languages, there's always this marshaling, this uncomfortable transition as you jump out of the shell into the utility and then back.
Right. We tried to minimize that as much as possible. It's one of these, this is actually a problem I've been thinking about for about 20 years. How can we take a shell language, or what's the difference between a shell language and a scripting language or a programming language? And you know, the big thing is that shell does a lot more for you automatically. It does expansions and it does wildcards and all of these things that you really don't want to have going on in your programs. So how do you separate them out? And we've kind of come up with this sort of dual syntax mode where commands, when you type a command on the command line, it works like a command. But then if you do an expression, it works much more like a traditional programming language. And we try to keep it sort of down to two modes. One of the things, again, that you see in a traditional shell is it has a million sort of micro modes. It has this little mode where expressions work, and this little mode where variables get expanded, and this little mode where string substitution occurs. And each one has its own individual syntax, and they're sort of all nested together in a fairly confusing mess.
Now, how hard does that make it for the person who's actually writing the parser? I mean, you know, I've done my computer science Lex and Yak work, and I've written little languages and created these different expression trees. But how difficult is it in PowerShell, since there are so many potential ways that you can modify the system? There's the type expansion where you can spot weld properties and methods onto objects. There's variables that can expand differently, whether they're using a single quote or a double quote around them. There's all the different commands that might already be in your path. Does that make it difficult to design a language when you've got so many potential things existing already? I mean, you've got all of the .NET framework, you got everything that's in their path. You didn't just sit down from a complete blank slate and write the language. You had all this context to... I guess what I'm trying to say is that you've got the whole of the framework underneath you, as well as all this kind of DOS historical commands. How does that affect the way you design the language?
Well, the approach that we used, and Jim Truer, who was the PM on the PowerShell team, Jim and I worked together to design the language. This is sort of the normal way that Microsoft works. You have a developer, and you have something called a program manager, whose job is to be the customer's advocate. So they look at what the developer is saying and basically say, no, you're an idiot. You can't do that. Nobody will ever use that. And the programmer's job is to say, I can't do that. That's impossible. You want me to solve the halting problem? I'm sorry. We can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so what we did actually is we started with the POSIX shell grammar, right? If you're going to start with designing a new language, you want to start with something that has been proven. In a sense, what we did is we took the same sort of approach to designing the PowerShell language that the Java guys took. You look at an existing very successful language, mm-hmm. and you say, okay, what are our core characteristics? In Java's case, it was the garbage collection and pervasive object orientation.
Right.
We had, again, the pervasive object orientation. And we said, okay, what do we need to change? How do we have to go through the language and change it to work in this environment? And it actually turned out to be a huge change because it completely breaks the way all traditional shells work, where they do this process of expansion and then parsing. Mm-hmm. That it's not going to work because you lose all the structure of the object. So we had to go to a much more traditional language design. It's a basic recursive descent parser. It is a context-sensitive grammar in the sense that the interpretation of a node is subject to where it appears in the source text. Mm. So that makes it a little bit tricky. And there are a lot of deals between the parser and the tokenizer. But we tried to keep it as simple as possible and as flexible as possible. And it was a lot of taking things out. This characteristic, no, we're going to take that out. It's too complicated.
Yeah.
So we did, again, just like the Java guy said, you know, we looked at C++ and we'll take out all the things that don't make sense. And we aren't going to worry about backwards compatibility. That was also another critical design characteristic that, we will be informed by history, but we won't be a slave to history. So if something is known to be a problem or known to be confusing for users, we'll just take it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the basic shell syntax was also informed. Jeffrey had worked a lot with DCL, and he liked the very regular DCL syntax. So we adopted a lot of that from DAC. We had a variety of source languages. Perl was very high up early on. We did some language reviews and got some user feedback. And a lot of the Perlisms, we retained some, but a lot of them were didn't go over very well with users, didn't go over very well with the reviewers. And the other thing that we decided to do a little later on was to align the language more with C#, primarily because of the conciseness of the notation. If you have a sort of a more of an ALGOL-based language with begin and end, it's hard to type much on a command line.
Mm-hmm.
And the average PowerShell script is going to be 80 characters long because that's the length of what you can conveniently type on in a console window. So
is that why you chose to have curly braces as your block?
That's right.
As opposed to like something like Boo or Python that just uses mm-hmm. white space?
Again, white space, it's what you can conveniently type on one line. So Python, the new line stuff is actually very cool. It has some nice characteristics. It was actually based on a language that was designed to teach programming.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a little bit more verbose, and it scatters the text across multiple lines. And in a console window environment, that's a little hard to edit. So we wanted to be able to type significantly complex structures, while loops and for loops, all on one line.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the drivers there.
And hence, that I've heard the term write-only language. Mm-hmm. A write-only language is kind of a pejorative that people use to refer to a language that is very easy to write or easier for some people to write, but completely impossible to read. And I've seen some pretty crazy stuff done with PowerShell all on one line. And have a little trouble sometimes reading PowerShell. How did you make the decision on things like using -EQ instead of an equal sign? Because things like that, for me at least, when I read PowerShell scripts, I kind of stumble over. It's a little bit of a block that I, a speed bump even.
Right. And that one was interesting. I mean, that was a huge debate. And really the reason that we decided to go with those, the -EQ rather than equal sign and greater than and less than, was to support redirection. We could have actually used the equals and not equals, but in the end we decided that we would be more consistent and use the dash sequences for all of the operators because people want to be able to use redirection. And because it's a shell, redirection was more important to users than logical operations.
Mm-hmm.
And we had considered the idea of introducing modal parsing again, and decided in the end that no, we didn't want to do that because you can. A lot of the operators work on collections, so you can select objects from the collections that with a single application of an operator, you can select things from a list, for example. You may want to use redirection to save those to a file. And so if we had used greater than and less than, et cetera, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the things that I've had the most trouble with are like the hash tables when it starts getting into, you know, at signs and curly braces and parentheses and things like that. And I know that you can do a lot of really amazing things with both hash tables and arrays. that you kind of wish, I wish that I could do in C sharp, you know, just being able to say, you know, $A plus equals comma, and then just slap some things on the end of an array.
Right.
How do you balance the, you know, kind of really terse but very useful things like that, that because they're so terse, they're almost obscure, and the average developer is not going to sit down and say, gosh, I wonder if they've overloaded arrays such that I can do this on one line. And a C-sharp or VB programmer might find themselves doing all sorts of crazy things like array.resize in order to do something that could be expressed in a very crisp way with PowerShell.
Right. It's a little bit interesting because, you see people coming at it from a programmer background and they want to do exactly what you said and use some of the traditional programmer style approaches. One of the most interesting ones is that a pipeline generates a collection of objects. And so you don't need to loop through the pipeline and add them to an array. You'll just get an array out of it. So that's an interesting approach to solving the problems that seems a little alien to a lot of programmers. But one of the things that's pretty important about the design of PowerShell is that we have what we call elastic syntax. So you can use these short forms, these little aliases and things, to write very terse stuff on the command line. But when you're writing scripts, we recommend that you use the non-aliased forms of the names because they're much more understandable. And so you can write in a very concise style. You have to be able to do that. It's a shell. You need to be able to write stuff very, very densely. But at the same time, we provide mechanisms so that you can write very elaborated and much easier to read code. It shouldn't be much more difficult to read PowerShell code than C-sharp code if you're a conscientious programmer. It's really up to the programmer. You're not forced to write opaque code, but you can write some opaque code. You can do some crazy things in PowerShell.
You didn't just sit down and with the advent of the new features in C-sharp 3.0 and presumably things coming in C-sharp 3.5 and being able to say var A equals whatever. There, it seems like the direction that all languages are going in, whether it be VB9 or PowerShell itself, they seem to be converging on some kind of a thing, on a general way of thinking where there's just syntactic sugar, there's just skins over the language themselves. Given that those languages were being developed around the same time as PowerShell, why not just make the language of PowerShell C-sharp?
C-sharp still requires a lot of additional syntax. So, for example, if you want to copy a file, you have to do file.copy, open paren, double quote, file name 1, close double quote, comma, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not very shell-friendly.
Mm.
Now, one of the things, because PowerShell is a .NET language, can use .NET stuff directly, it's very easy to extend PowerShell with C-sharp or VB or any .NET language. You can just compile the class, load it, and use it. So that makes it fairly straightforward. The other thing that PowerShell provides is the ability to dynamically create or dynamically extend objects. So when we actually do this a lot. The design of the objects in .NET are pretty good, but there are still some inconsistencies. Arrays have a length property. Collections have a count property.
Right.
Process have process name. File has name. So there's inconsistencies across the different objects. And that's a pain for, especially for administration. That's one of the big things that WMI tried to address was to canonicalize the set of names that people use. And that's one of the things that PowerShell does. You can use the count property on an array. We add the synthetic property on top of the array type, so you can use count universally. Likewise, we add different properties on objects, so that, again, you get a much more consistent naming experience.
How many things like that are that? I mean, did you go through the entire kind of like set of things people would do regularly and just kind of lint them, kind of with the philosophy of fall into the pit of success kind of way of thinking?
Well, once upon a time, we started to do that, and we can spend a long, long time trying to do that. We're working with the other groups within Microsoft to try and encourage canonicalization of objects. We did a handful of things that are very commonly used. files and processes and services and things like that, but we have nowhere near the full coverage. In our early grand plans, we were going to do everything and have all of these smart types that would know the world, but we're not that big of a team.
Yeah, and at that point, you'd be getting close to, is it really PowerShell's responsibility to clean up kind of the sins of the father?
Right. And this is something that, we work with the base class library team and the NetFX teams to try and establish some guidelines and likewise to make sure that we also follow their guidelines. This is an ongoing effort to try and come up with coding standards and object design standards that everybody can live with.
Now, will we see PowerShell libraries or scripts or kind of commandlet packs coming out of your team, or is your team going to only be new versions of PowerShell?
That's actually up in the air. In the ideal world, it would be best if the domain experts provided the commandlets for their technology areas.
Mm-hmm.
In practice, I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll probably still provide some tools and utilities and so forth. How the actual partitioning will work will evolve over time.
Now, one of the things that I want to ask you about just at the end of our half an hour here are script block parameters. If you could explain script block parameters, kind of what they are, why they're not exactly obvious, and what kind of power they provide to someone, because I think that people might be trying to solve problems where I think a script block parameter might be exactly what the doctor ordered.
Right. So a script in Unix shells, there is a way to say, I want, instead of reading my parameter from the command line, I want to read it from the pipeline. And you do this by saying dash. So, for example, you could cat a script file into awk and say dash f dash, and that says, read my source file from standard input instead of reading it from a file or on the command line or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is it's a powerful compositional model. And we wanted to sort of generalize this. We tried a variety of nasty syntactic fiddles, none of which were particularly satisfactory, and all of which were baroque.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we said, well, we have these script blocks, right, that can do arbitrary transformations. And so what we will do is we'll say, rather than providing the parameter on the command line or even reading it directly from the pipeline, we'll allow you to specify a small piece of code in the form of a script block, and it will take the inbound object and it will do whatever transformation on it that you need, whether it's a special type conversion or you want to multiply it by two or you want to take some sub-property out of that property. Basically, anything that you need to do, you can do with this transformation. And in a lot of cases, it eliminates the need for putting the command in a for each loop, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of piping into for each, you can just pipe directly into the command and use a script block. And then the script block gets run once for each inbound pipeline object and doing the transformation, and then the command executes.
Yeah, we've used the script blocks and script block parameters for the using them for import CSV. I just think it's so funny that we spend all these years moving towards XML, and then on our projects where we use PowerShell scripting in a very deep way, we keep falling back on comma-separated values for our structured data format. It seems like it's a step forward, but also a kind of a step back. It's just structured data without the angle brackets, but it still feels weird.
Well, I mean, a lot of people say, we've done the structured data thing already. It was called Lisp. Adding angle brackets doesn't make it all that much difference.
Yeah.
But XML is actually not a great format for people. It's lots of angle brackets, and it's fairly hard to type, and so on. You can read it, but you wouldn't want to write it. It's good for computers. They can read and write it. But it's not a great notation for a lot of purposes, which is why you see a lot of people using the JSON notation with JavaScript, which is just an indented data structure. It's much simpler than XML.
Sure. And it would be fairly straightforward, given the structure of JSON and the flexibility of it, to build in import and export JSON, JSON, for PowerShell.
Right. And that's something that, I think we flirted with that for about 3 minutes in our copious spare time. But it's certainly something that we did look at as being an alternative data format.
Yeah. It sounds like an interesting thing because you, as the shell designers, get to basically punt by saying, hey, we're just the shell. And interestingly, though, the community does rise up and solve that problem. One of the things that I've been amazed at is how quickly people have taken things in PowerShell that they found distasteful and expanded on them. The first thing that I saw that I didn't like was the lack of IntelliSense, but because tab expansion was a function of its own in its own right, and you have full reflection abilities, there have been some amazing tab expansion macros that I'm probably sure you run yourself that people have created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were pretty happy with that, and that's one of the things where I see the PowerShell environment evolving to a large extent is to make more of that customizable, so that if people don't like a particular behavior, then they can extend it themselves. That's kind of the point of this type of environment.
So, your book is called PowerShell in Action, Windows PowerShell in Action, and it's up at Manning Publications at manning.com/payette, manning.com/ and your last name. It looks like it's coming out week after next, February 12th.
That would be about right. The ebook should be available now, and I just finished tarting together all of the examples, so you should be able to download those directly from the Manning website, and then the print book will be following shortly thereafter.
And it looks like the complete PowerShell grammar is in Appendix C of that book.
That's right, including the tokenization rules.
Now, if I understand correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you've got MSI and what people are familiar with, like MSI Exec. There's that installer technology. And early versions of PowerShell were installed with MSI. Then there's I think what you guys call update.exe, which is the we're not an installer as we are an add-on or an update to the OS. And one of the ways that I'm able to sell PowerShell internally and to other companies is I say, hey, this isn't something we just slap onto Windows. This is an actual KB. You don't see it. If you go into add remove programs, you have to click on show updates because it's literally, embedded into the system. So then those are the two installer technologies I'm familiar with. And then there's something new in Vista around installer?
That's right. Yeah, there's a new component-based installation mechanism in Vista that is designed to address some of the limitations of Windows Update. I don't know the details particularly. I didn't work in that area.
But we're going to see that in PowerShell any time now?
Soon. So I can't say specifics.
Sure. But before the end of 2007, we'll have PowerShell on Vista.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet, yes.
Good deal. Well, I'm looking forward to that. And hopefully the book and the Vista version of PowerShell come out around the same time, because I'm going to start suggesting this book to all my friends. I really did enjoy. I got to see an early access edition of the PowerShell in Action. I think as you were writing it, they were putting chapters up there, which I thought was a pretty cool thing to do for a publishing company.
Yeah, it was. I was a little skeptical about it initially, but it turned out to be great because I had a chance to really actively take feedback. Somebody would ask, "Say, well, this portion of the book is unclear," or "I'd like to see this explained." And I was able to go back into the chapters and add new text, new examples, and really incorporate some of the reader's feedback in the first version of the book instead of having to wait, 2 years and do version two or something like that.
Right. It sounds like it definitely made it a better book.
Yeah, I was skeptical initially. I thought, who would even participate in this? But we had a really good group of people. They contributed a lot of information and a lot of feedback. I was very happy with it.
Well, it looks like it's a really good deal. If you go up to manning.com/payette, you can get the ebook for $22.50, and you can get the ebook and the soft print, the actual softbound paperback, for $44.99. So pretty good deal for a book, considering that you can get the ebook immediately and they'll ship the actual book to you. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to talk to us here. Interesting stuff. I could talk for another hour or two with you. It's so interesting to hear about how someone would actually design a language from scratch, and I do appreciate your time.
Well, thanks very much. Good talking to you.
All right, and this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.